In 2004, the book Gilead was published by Marilyn Robinson, a book that I'm sure many of you have read, and if not, I will spoil it for you this morning, so my apologies ahead of time. Chesterton did say the lowest circle in hell is for those who ruin the end of a good story, so I'm venturing on apparently very dangerous territory, but here goes anyway. It is a novel that takes the form of a letter or a journal, written by an aging and likely dying congregational minister. And the journal or the letters are written to his then 7-year-old son, a child that he was granted late in life and something that he did not expect. He was formerly married in his younger years, had a wife and a child who died tragically. And he thought that that was it for him, but he later in life did get married and had this son, and he wants to pass on as much as he can to this child who will never know him kind of in the vigor of his youth. And so this book kind of carries out in narrative form some of the letters. And in one passage, John Ames, the minister, writes these words to his son. Now this might seem a trivial thing to mention, considering the gravity of the subject, but I truly don't feel that it is. We were very pious children from very pious households in a fairly pious town, and this affected our behavior considerably. Once, we baptized a litter of cats. It occurred to one of the girls to swaddle them up in a doll's dress, like a baptismal gown, but there was only one dress, which is just as well, since the cats could hardly tolerate a moment in it and would have to have been unsaddled as soon as they were christened in any case. I myself moistened their brows, repeating the full Trinitarian formula. Their grim old crooked-tailed mother found us baptizing away by the creek and began carrying her babies off by the napes of their necks. We lost track of which one was which, and we were fairly sure that some of the creatures had been borne away still in the darkness of paganism, and that worried us a great deal. I still remember how those little brows felt under the palm of my hand. Everyone has petted a cat, but to touch one like that, with the pure intention of blessing it, it is a very different thing. It stays the mind. For years, we would wonder what, from a cosmic viewpoint, we had done to them. It still seems to me to be a real question. There is a reality in blessing. It doesn't enhance sacredness, but it acknowledges it, and there is a real power in that. I have felt it pass through me, so to speak. The sensation is one of really knowing a creature. I mean, really feeling its mysterious life and your own mysterious life all at the same time. I don't wish to be urging the ministry on you, but there are some advantages to it that you might not know to take count of if I did not point them out. Not that you have to be a minister to confer blessing. You are simply much more likely to find yourself in that position. It's a thing people expect of you. I don't know why there is so little about this aspect of the ministerial calling in the literature. End quote. Well, the novel is taken up with the question of blessing. What it is and what it means and who gets it. And in large measure, that is the subject of our text this morning. Blessing. I mean, what is it and what does it do? And does it really do anything at all? I mean, every week at the end of this service, just like today, we will end it with a blessing, a benediction, a good word, or, you know, etymologically, a well wish. And I think for a lot of people, it's kind of just how we know the service is ending. It's like when the kids are finally relieved, that we know it's all downhill from here. Some people think it's just kind of a formal goodbye or kind of a wish of peace or a prayer or a desire that things would just go well with you once you're gone. But does it do anything at all? Or is it just a way to conclude a service or a final statement? Well, interestingly enough, the placement of the benediction in the Reformed liturgy is largely based on Luke's gospel. The benediction had found its way out of the service during the medieval church, and largely by both the pushing of Luther and then the repetition of Calvin, it was reinstated in the service, and the text that they used to prove their point was the ending text of Luke chapter 24, verses 50 and following, when Christ Himself blesses the disciples. You'll notice they don't go to the Old Testament and start pointing to what the priest did, as much as they will use that as well, but rather they use this New Testament priest and his final words on earth. So that's where I want us to begin this morning, is with the last words. This is the final act, if you will, of Jesus prior to the ascension. We see Christ ascend here and also in the first chapter of Acts. And many commentators don't see much going on, probably like some of you at the end of the service. They look at this and they say, well, this is just kind of what people do. You look at the literature of the time, and when an important person leaves the scene, this is kind of how they do it. They have this kind of big final speech, or what they call leave-taking. But if you look carefully at Luke's language, and not just his language, but with the care with which he places both this story and others, we will see that he has far more intentionality here than Jesus just kind of saying formally goodbye to the disciples. It is to remind us quite intentionally, as we will see, of the priestly benediction in the temple. Well, how is that so? I mean, look at the language that Luke does use. You at least see at surface level, even if you weren't, you know, a scholar, that it seems to be some sort of formal rite that is taking place. I mean, Jesus raises his hands, you know, and not to wave goodbye. He raises his hands in the air, and then he gives a blessing. And Luke is so intent on making sure you know that this is a formal blessing, he repeats it twice. He says he lifts his hands and he blesses them, and after blessing them, he departed from them. Well, why does this matter? Because in Luke's use of language, he's drawing clearly both from the scriptural tradition as well as the current Jewish practice of what the priest himself does at a particular portion of the temple service. I think for a lot of us, when we think of the temple service and the priesthood, largely because of the book of Hebrews, we mainly focus on Christ as priest, in particular on reflecting on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, that one time a year where one priest gets to enter into the Holy of Holies. And that is the service of the priesthood that most of us are familiar with, but there was a daily service in the temple. Every morning and every evening, offerings were given, and this is the Tamid service. In this service, you'll notice that the people gather around, especially at the evening service, and they pray as the priest goes about his business. In this daily service, you'll notice the priest is not allowed into the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant is, but he's in the room previous to that, on the other side of the curtain, in the holy place, where he offers an incense offering, and he prays for the people, and then he comes out after the incense offering, and in the evening service, he raises his hands, and he gives the Aaronic benediction over the people as they are waiting in prayer for him to come out. After that, more offerings are given, and so forth. The Bible reflects on this in Leviticus, but even in the literature of the time, there's a second century, a book written in the early second century called The Wisdom of Ben Sira, and he reflects on what the priests were doing. A particular priest, Simeon, at the time, was doing when he was doing the Tamid service in the temple. And he writes this way, that after he had offered the incense offering, he was departing outside, and quote, he came down, he would raise his hands over all the congregation of Israel, and the blessing of the Lord would be on his lips. The book of Leviticus puts it this way, and Aaron lifted up his hands towards the people, that should sound familiar, and he blessed them. And he came down from offering the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord appeared. So I want to argue that what Jesus is doing here is an official priestly action, that it's not accidental, that Luke really is trying to tie him both to the temple service and to the priesthood itself by ending his gospel with this particular benediction, hands raised in action. I'm not alone, as I've mentioned, in arguing this. Others have done it before me, but of course it doesn't matter in one sense what Luther and Calvin say if the scripture doesn't support it. And I want to show us as we go forward that Luke goes out of his way to tell us and to flag to us this is exactly what he intends to be teaching at the end of this gospel. So if those are the last words, I want us to see now the first act. Maybe you'll remember, we're going to go way back in the time machine here, to the very first set of sermons that we did in the Gospel of Luke, and the very first character we met in the Gospel. Do you remember who it was by chance? Not the one he introduces it to, but the first person he introduces us to in the narrative happens to be a priest named Zechariah. And this priest named Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, his first actions as a character in the Gospel of Luke are performing, surprise, surprise, happy coincidence, as we say as Calvinists, he's performing the incense offering in the service of Tamid, the normal daily priestly service. Luke tells us that it was time for Zechariah, his time as the priest, to kind of daily be in the temple. And it says after he had gone in to offer the incense offering, he has this strange encounter with an angel. And the angel, of course, tells him what he's going to do for him and his wife Elizabeth and how they'll have a son born to them. And Zechariah's having a hard time grasping it. There's some doubt in there. And because of it, you'll remember that Zechariah's speech is stolen from him. But you'll notice as he's in there having his conversation with an angel, Luke tells us two things about the crowd outside. It tells us, one, there is a crowd assembled, and they're assembled for prayers, because that's what they do. Morning and evening, they assemble for prayers. And this is the ninth hour of the day, this is the evening prayer, and they're all there assembled. And Luke tells us, as the conversation's going on, it must have taken some time, because he then tells us, and the people were waiting for Zechariah to come out. Well, if they just gathered for private prayers, there's no need to wait for Zechariah. But what were they waiting for? They were waiting for him to come out as priest and to raise his hands and to speak the benediction of God over them, that same Aaronic benediction that had been spoken for generations in Israel. But what happens? Well, you remember, Zechariah comes out, but he cannot speak. He's mute. There is no blessing for the nation of Israel. There are no good words to be spoken for Israel. And that may just sound like a coincidence when you begin the gospel, but if you look at what Luke does throughout the gospel, he really is showing us ahead of time there is a problem in Israel and with her temple and with all of its shortcomings as far as how it deals with the people and their actual needs. There is no lasting blessing that can be spoken over the nation, at least in her current form. This has been an issue, of course, ever since the garden. How do we get back to blessing and actually keep it? I mean, how many times has Israel been brought into the blessings of God only to be just like us and let them slip very quickly out of their oily fingers? All that had been given through the law, as good as it was, including the priesthood and the temple, could not secure for Israel what they and every other human being so desperately desires: blessing, fullness, goodness of God overflowing in their life. I mean, we see it in our own lives. How do sinful people, people who are prone to wander, prone to self-love, prone to even despair and pessimism, how do they get a blessing spoken over their lives? I mean, what would even justify someone speaking a blessing over our life? But not only that, how do we keep it, or how do we even verify that it's true considering the sufferings of this life? It's one thing to consider oneself blessed. You can have, the home goods version of whatever blessing printed out on a frame and put on over your kitchen table. But as much as we read the positive words about how everything is good and how this is a good day, there's a lot of days in our life that we look at and doesn't feel like a blessing. Or even worse, we know that it's not a blessing. Real hurt is done to us. We cause real harm. And real tragedy does strike even at our own doorsteps. So how do people who suffer so tragically and experience the real and deep pangs of this existence begin to imagine that they are blessed? I mean, this really is John Ames' problem in the story of Gilead. The story revolves around this question of blessing, but in particular, John Ames, the minister of this congregational church, and the son of his best friend, a Presbyterian minister, who named this particular son after John Ames. He was so loved his friend that he wanted to honor him by giving him a namesake and letting him be his godfather, but also in one sense to be a replacement for the child that John himself lost. It was to be a son to him and for him. But Jack has really been, who is the nickname for his namesake, John Ames, John Ames Jr. here, or not really Jr., but the Presbyterian minister's son goes by the name of Jack. And he's always been a thorn in the side of his godfather. I mean, at first he's a thorn in his side because it's just a painful and ugly reminder that he's not really his own son and that his own child isn't coming back and it does not replace either the child of his youth or the wife that went with it. It's also an ugly reminder of his lack of blessedness in this area. While his good friend, the Presbyterian minister Boughton, continues to have children for, like every good Presbyterian should have. No. But of course, it's not just the lack that he reminds him of. If you read the story, Jack later makes himself a nuisance, not only to his godfather, but to everyone in town. But it begins with Minister Ames as he recounts to his own son through these letters. He says, "I was thinking about the time when Jack was just 10 or 12, and he filled my mailbox with wood shavings and then set them all on fire." It went from these practical jokes to then stealing of family heirlooms, where he thought it would be funny to steal Reverend Ames's grandfather's Greek New Testament and a photograph of his then deceased wife. Worst of all, Jack ends up impregnating a young girl, an indigent, only to abandon her. He took advantage of the girl's admiration of him and was completely callous once the child was known about. His parents, ever dutiful Presbyterians, wanted to care for the girl, being filled with guilt and shame for their own son's actions. And yet, despicable Jack was happy to offload all the guilt and responsibility onto his family. And he left them in the lurch, much like the prodigal, which surely the story is modeled after. In his adult life, Jack forgoes pranks or the wiles of youth, and instead, when he comes back to town, continues to be a pain to Minister Ames by really pestering his emotional and intellectual vulnerabilities as an old man. And you can just feel the strain of their relationship throughout the whole story. He wants to love Jack. He knows he has this burden to love him. It's his own godson. And yet he can never quite get his mind around this young man because he just seems so thoroughly rotten. He grieves. He grieves that the young man aggravates him so much. He grieves that Jack makes him so angry. And though he loves Jack, there's one thing he cannot imagine, and that is a blessing for Jack. When he recounts the episode of Jack's disgrace over the years, he says in his letters that he's dishonorable and that his dishonor is recalcitrant and that he feels as a pastor he has nothing to give a dishonorable person. He can talk about certain sins. Of course, forgiveness is real for certain kinds of people with certain sorts of sins, but someone who is just set in being a disgrace and is really burdened and bent that way, I can't help them. Is his mind in the situation. When the priest comes out of the temple, metaphorically speaking, to speak over Jack's life, there is no blessing for him. There's just silence, much like Zechariah has for Israel. There's nothing to be said because of the condition they're in. What can be said of us and the condition that we're born in, the life that we live, and the suffering that we endure? I mean, how can there be some word spoken over us that really changes somehow everything once we depart? I mean, like it or not, this is our condition, and all the well wishes or good words in the world don't seem to be able to change it. And yet, if that is the first act, you will notice that's not where Luke leaves us. So I want us to see the last act this morning. Why does the priest have to come out? I mean, why does he come out to the people? Why do they wait in prayers? I mean, he's off doing his business on the inside. Can't they just pray and go home and assume that's all is well? And why do they have to wait for this benediction to be spoken over their life? Well, very much in the vein of the literature, it's as if without the benediction, the sacrifice would be suspect or incomplete. Like, how do we know? How do we know God received the sacrifice of the priest? How do we know that the priest even performed the sacrifice? The way to know it, the way to tangibly receive what was done out of sight, because mind you, the people can't see the work of the priest. He's on the inside in the holy place offering sacrifices on their behalf. But it's when he comes outside to them and speaks the good words over them that they know that the sacrifice is both given and received. And in that sense, all is well. Jesus' last act before the ascension is a blessing. And it's a blessing because he goes up not only as the one who has given a sacrifice on our behalf, but he goes up to do a priestly work from that moment on that will be a blessing to us. But it will be a work that is out of sight and invisible to us. And how will we know by sight what is happening both in his cross work and in the work once he is ascended? Well, he comes and he speaks this blessing over his disciples. The blessing given because of the sacrifice given. But also because of the fact that that sacrifice was about to be presented before the face of God as Christ ascends into heaven as a pleasing aroma to his Father and will ever live and be present there at his right hand in that capacity as our priest and sacrifice, as our Redeemer, to where God the Father will ever be able to look at him and know that his thoughts towards us are only good and never evil, that he is only for us and not against us, that there really is a blessing, not just spoken over our life, but enacted on our behalf. And that blessing ever lives now to intercede as a priest on our behalf. And think about the very first chapters of the Bible in creation. For 6 days, God is creating, and every time he is done, he says, it's good, it's good, it's good, until he pans in the whole of it. And he says, it's all very good. And according to the text, it says, he didn't just speak those words, but he blessed creation and spoke those words. Well, why did he give a blessing at that moment? Because he was done. It was his way of speaking that everything was completed and all was well. And you'll notice at that moment he entered into his rest as the Creator, never to be working in that capacity again. And he spoke a benediction over his created work. And so Jesus looks at his work, his life and his death and his resurrection. And in the benediction he pronounces that it's done. And that it's all very good, that all has come to perfection. And we can know this because he gives that blessing to his disciples, and as soon as he blesses them, what does he do? He enters into his Sabbath rest, along with his Father, where they ever wait for us to be joined with them in that rest. His work is finished. He sat down at the right hand of God, and it's finished because it is complete and perfect and blessed. And because of it, you're complete. And in the eyes of the Father presently, you are perfect. And by sight, the last day, you will be as well. But more, especially this morning, you are blessed. Which is why the blessing is not only the last words spoken, if you will, in the gospel, but every time we gather, they're the last words spoken. God has the final word in every service, and the word that he speaks are good words over you and over the life that you take with you from this place. This isn't just a well wish or a prayer. Hopefully things go well with you this week. It is God's declaration that is performative. It gives what it speaks. Because God is saying in the benediction, I'm putting my name on you. I go with you wherever you go. And where I am, there is always blessedness. And since I am for you and not against you, everything that you encounter You can see through these new eyes. In the benediction, His name is genuinely put on us. And I know that's hard for us to imagine, so maybe you can imagine it in this crass illustration. You know, what if every week as I, you know, raised my hands in benediction, that the deacons and elders all scrambled and grabbed Sharpies, and then, you know, chair by chair, they wrote on your forehead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So that everywhere you went and every time you looked in the mirror, you knew not only that His name was placed on you, but that He was for you in blessing. Because that's what's happening. It's not, again, a prayer. It is God's declaration that because of Christ's sacrifice, because of His priestly work, you are blessed. That things are well with you, even if you can't discern them because of the sufferings of this life. But as Paul says, all of these things pale in comparison to the glory that is to be ours in Christ, and that is already ours, secured by the sacrifice that happened and His priestly work that He now engages in our behalf. As Christ raises His hands in blessing on His disciples, He defines them, He promises Himself to them, and He seals to them the benefits of all of His work as they go forth into the world to do His bidding. And that's what happens week in and week out here. As we come and see Christ preach, as we partake of Him at the table, God sends us out back into a world surely of trouble and suffering and even our own sin. And He says, know that where you go, I am there with you and for you in blessing. So how does Jack's story end? And in one sense, then how does ours? And this is where I'm ruining the book for you. But if you haven't read it now, I'm blaming you for letting it come to this. John Ames writes to his young son about his last interaction with Jack, which, remember, he also wears the name John Ames, so don't be confused in the quote. After seeing him and seeing that he's a burdened man trying to do what he can, he sees finally in Jack himself and his own weaknesses and his own sins and his own need of blessing apart from any doing. Just like Israel of old needed a blessing, not because they had finally earned one, but because it had been shown through the law that they would never accomplish what God required. And so now he turns to him as a minister with new eyes toward this one that he formerly thought of as too disgraceful for goodness. It says, as he's looking at him, he took his hat off and he set it on his knees and he closed his eyes and he lowered his head, almost rested against my hand. And I did bless him to the limit of my powers, whatever they are. Repeating the benediction from Numbers, of course. The Lord make His face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up His countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Nothing can be more beautiful than that. Or more expressive of my feelings, certainly. Or more sufficient, for that matter. Then, when he didn't open his eyes or deign to lift up his head, I said, Lord, bless thee, John Ames Boughton, this beloved son and brother and husband and father. And then he sat back and he looked at me as if he were waking out of a dream. You see, this is what happens week in and week out as the gospel is preached and eaten and ultimately pronounced over you. That God Himself is placing His hand on you and saying to you, all is well. You're a beloved son and father and husband and brother, daughter and wife and mother. That I am for you and not against you, and that whatever meets you this week, this is the one thing certain, that the God of the universe has done all that is necessary to ensure that the last words spoken over your life will be a blessing and not a curse. May we thank Him for that this morning as we continue in worship. Let us pray.